I should remark on the empty seat, Judge Mannion is participating by speakerphone from South Bend as he is recovering from an injury. It's an example of the fact that those people who want to engage in physical exercise also take risks, which in this case did not pan out well for our colleague. But we wish him a speedy recovery, and he will be here in spirit, and his electrons will also be here. So, Ms. Krause.
Thank you, Judge. We certainly appreciate Judge Mannion's efforts, Judge. May it please the Court, good afternoon. My name is Michelle Krause. I'm here with Stanley Campbell. We represent the appellant, Gregory Scott Johnson. Johnson maintains that the state has prevented him from filing a full and complete petition identifying each and every colorable claim for relief because the state has withheld exculpatory material evidence. It is the wrongful actions of the state, the intentional secreting of the evidence, that prevented Johnson from asserting his claims. There is an obvious, can't ignore the obvious procedural issue here. Johnson's petition was filed one day late, past the statute of limitations. Both briefs obviously address that issue. Johnson maintains that he is entitled to equitable tolling under two separate theories. The first theory is that is under 2244D1D, which states that the statute of limitations runs from the year from the latest of the date on which the factual predicate of the claim or claims presented could have been discovered through the exercise of due diligence. There's an issue here concerning that exercise of due diligence. The issue that is raised and that Johnson maintains was secreted is this court order from Paul Becker. Paul Becker was a friend, a very close acquaintance of Gregory Scott Johnson's. And immediately prior to his jury trial in 1986, the Madison County Prosecutor's Office obtained a court order to take the pubic hairs of Paul Becker. That order was obtained, I believe it was 2 weeks prior to the jury trial. It was sent to the FBI lab. There was a letter that was sent that said, "This is urgent, we need a response immediately." That court order, the police report which was generated indicating that that happened, was not discovered until the PCR proceedings. The history behind the police report and the withholding of evidence is that Johnson's trial counsel filed a motion for discovery requesting police reports and fire reports. This was an arson case. He was denied, trial counsel was denied that discovery.
I'm not sure how, in your view, this affects the time to pursue a federal collateral attack.
In the sense, Judge, that if, because the statute requires due diligence on the appellant's part in obtaining that factual information, going all the way back to trial counsel's efforts to obtain those police reports, because it's within those police reports that the information was first discovered that this court order was obtained. So in that sense, to show Johnson's due diligence in trying to find that court order.
Well, I mean, the police reports were kept secret from his counsel?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Under Indiana law, they're considered work product. And so at each stage during the trial proceedings, trial counsel filed a motion for discovery, filed a motion to compel, and then there was a stipulation prior to the cross-examination of each of the police or fire personnel indicating that a report had in fact been prepared but not been provided to the defense counsel. The trial judge then ordered, he was not interested in looking at the police reports, he ordered them sealed and sent to the Supreme Court for the purpose of the direct appeal. There were 19 police officer and fire officers' reports which were sealed, and appellate counsel did have access to those, and to a certain extent in the direct appeal did reference.
So he went through each one of those documents himself, the reports.
Absolutely. Of the 19 that were sent, however, during the course of the post-conviction proceedings, there were additional reports that were found pursuant to a subpoena to the Anderson Police Department, I think it was, and to the Anderson Fire Department. There were several other police reports which were never sent to the Supreme Court, nor did appellate counsel have access to those reports. It's within those reports that were found during the PCR that we find the April 24th, 1986 police report, which says that the court order...
But can we come back to my question? How does this bear on the federal statute? That is, you're going to have to tell us on what day, through the exercise of due diligence, the court order would have been discovered, and then show that the federal collateral attack was filed within 1 year of that day.
Well,
so in your view, on what day would it have been discovered?
It hasn't been discovered, Judge. It is within the Madison County prosecutor's file.
So on what day was it discovered?
The court order itself was discovered in March of 1999. It is the application for that court order, however, which the court order simply says that the court, having found based upon the application that the order should be issued, issued the order. So it is the application which has the information which Johnson needs to collaterally attack his conviction and, almost more importantly, his sentence. It is that application which there was a pre-petition discovery motion that was filed prior to the running of the statute of limitations. That was Johnson's effort.
On what day did counsel know that this application existed?
I believe the exact day in March, I apologize, I can't provide the court, but I'm certain it was in March of 1999 that it was found.
None of this information is in your brief. And I looked very hard in the brief to try to find critical dates, because under the federal statute, you need to know what these dates are, and then you need to be able to run a year from them.
Judge, I believe in the brief, although the exact March date is not referenced, but the fact that the court order was found in March of 1999 is referenced, because there is also a reference to the pre-petition discovery request, which was filed in May of 1999. I believe that was filed May 25th of 1999. That pre-petition discovery, the request for that was never ruled upon by the district court prior to the denial of the petition. The district court found, I believe it was on October 28th of 2003 when that order was issued, found that the issue of the pre-discovery petition was moot because obviously at that point the petition had been denied. So to answer your question, unfortunately, if something is being hid from the appellant, And obviously the manner in which the court order itself was found indicates a desire of the prosecutor's office for that application to not be found. The application on page 7...
There are two, when you say not be found, that's different from not be disclosed.
Well, Judge, to the extent that the records have been searched, the manner in which, and this is on page 17 of the brief, the manner in which the court order itself was found is such that it appears that there was an intention that it not be found. There is, Paul Decker's name appears on the court order, but Gregory Scott Johnson's name does not appear on the court order. It is an order for pubic hair, which we know from the police report was what got pulled from Paul Decker. And the date of the order is April 23rd of 1986. The police report, which was found, indicates that on April 24th of 1986 is when the pubic hairs were pulled. The PCR judge, in making his findings of fact, indicated that he was not going to speculate that that court order was in fact related to the Gregory Scott Johnson case, but there's certainly substantial circumstantial evidence that it's related. Paul Decker testified that the pubic hairs were obtained. There was a police officer who testified at the PCR hearing that he obtained the pubic hairs as a result of an order in Scott Johnson's case. And it's the application. We have an order. We know that happened. And originally, the state didn't even want to talk about the order. At the PCR hearing, the Madison County prosecutor at the time never conceded that there was a court order. He said if there is a court order for these pubic hairs to have been taken, it was the defense, the appellant's burden, to show that that happened. Well, we can now show that happened. The prosecutor also indicated that even if there is a court order, perhaps it was issued on something less than probable cause. Well, the Indiana Supreme Court has said clearly probable cause was necessary to get the court order. So it's the application, it's the information contained within that application, that probable cause that Paul Decker was involved in this crime, that Johnson is entitled to know in order to collaterally attack his conviction. And that information has yet to be determined because that court order, the application cannot be found. And again, going back to the prosecutor's comments during the course of the PCR proceedings, never did concede that there was a court order, but the order itself says upon application by Madison County prosecutor. So obviously they prepared it. Obviously they would be in possession of it. It is not in the court docket under Gregory Scott Johnson. It's not in the court docket for any of Paul Decker's other unrelated cases. So the only last place to look is in the Madison County prosecutor's office. And the pre-petition discovery, Johnson recognizes that to file an ex parte petition is an extreme step to take, but because of the nature and the history of the prosecutor's office not wanting to acknowledge even that the pubic hairs were pulled and the court order was obtained, leads one to believe that, in fact, they intended to not have Johnson know what they knew concerning Decker's involvement in this case. Johnson obviously maintains that the information contained in that application amounts to a Brady claim, a Brady violation, that it would be exculpatory and material for him to know that. And again, unfortunately, since that has not been located, despite Johnson's obvious diligent efforts to do so, he cannot completely collaterally attack under the federal statute.
And why?
Just because there's information we don't know. The prosecutor tried this case, and the death penalty, the sentencing phase of this case, as if there were a single person committing the crime. At the time, the law was that it was the shooter law, so it almost lowered the burden at sentencing to have to prove that Johnson was the one, in fact, who killed Ruby Hutzler. So it's important because we don't know what facts they knew that gave rise to probable cause to get a search warrant to pull his pubic hairs.
As best I can figure it out, the argument you are effectively making is that there is no statute of limitations ever for Brady claims. Because until the defense is convinced that no evidence was withheld, the statute of limitations doesn't start.
I don't believe that that's the position, Judge.
All right. You haven't yet explained what material exculpatory evidence was withheld and when you learned about it. What you're saying is that since the prosecutor denies that there was any exculpatory evidence and you haven't discovered the exculpatory evidence, the statute of limitations hasn't begun even as of today.
Well, Judge, the prosecutor denied that the court order existed back in the
court orders are not exculpatory evidence.
Sure. Absolutely, Judge. But every court order has to have a basis for that court order. There have to be facts presented under oath.
Yes. If I believe, or if a prosecutor believes, that Jones is involved in a crime, swears out a search warrant, the search warrant is issued and then executed, turns up nothing, right? The application for the search warrant is not exculpatory evidence.
It
isn't any evidence at all. It just is a suspicion, and it turned up nothing.
Well,
right? If one were to make a Brady claim based on that, you would not say the application for the search warrant is the exculpatory evidence.
It seems that the information in the application still needs to be provided to the defense.
No. What has to be provided to the defense is exculpatory evidence. Right? The argument you're now making is effectively any evidence the defense wants to see or any information the defense wants to see, it's entitled to. And the defense will then decide whether it's exculpatory. And until the defense gets it, the time to file a collateral attack hasn't even begun. But as I understand it, that's not the way Brady works. One has to show that there is exculpatory evidence and it was withheld.
In a situation where it's not just any evidence, but it's information that gave rise to probable cause, that's not mere suspicion that somebody was involved in a crime. It's a higher burden than that. So if there are just police reports lying around out there that the defense wants to take a look at...
Let me try a different measure. The prosecutor suspects that Jones was involved in the murder, and on that account asked for a check of Jones's fingerprints. They're checked, it's found to be clean. Right? Jones was not involved. Or the prosecutor suspects that Jones was involved and tests his DNA, found to be not involved. Do we have any exculpatory evidence here?
What you want to find out is what aroused the suspicions that led to the taking of the fingerprint.
Correct.
Okay.
Even after we know from the fingerprint or the DNA test that Jones wasn't involved.
But those aren't necessarily, that may not be the dispositive issue.
Yeah, but for purposes of this, it is. That the police are supposed to disclose their suspicions so that you will know what gave rise to the suspicions?
Mere suspicion isn't the same as probable cause.
If their suspicions are sufficiently formed, it is the ground for issuing search warrants. Search warrants are constantly issued and quashed. Search warrants are even after they've been served and the people and the meritorious within, search warrants are frequently issued, and nothing turns up. Doesn't find a thing, and that's the end of that. But what you're seeking is to find out what gave rise to that suspicion and giving that the elevated status of exculpatory evidence. And that's, as I understand it, that's what you're talking about. Am I correct, Judge Easterbrook, or am I misquoting?
That's what it sounds like.
Well, and to the extent that I don't believe that I'm disagreeing with the court.
Now, Paul and I sat around here discussing it one afternoon. We said that this guy's always seen in company of the defendant who's already admitted he committed the crime, and we'd like to find out whether he participated as well. So look, we want an opportunity to take samples, DNA samples or pubic hair samples. By the way, I hope it wasn't pulled. I hope clipped was the word.
No.
But it was pulled.
Pulled, Judge.
Well, that's proof positive that Indiana is still laboring in the dark ages. That would give a reasonable magistrate to say, okay, go look and go pull it, see what you got. You got nothing? That's the end of that.
Well,
but that doesn't provide you with exculpatory evidence. It's just that we are searching every avenue to find out whether or not there was more than one person involved there. Was there any talk at all during the time your client was talking to the police that there was somebody else involved?
Judge, no. He never... At the time that he was interviewed, he was picked up at approximately 6:15 in the morning, intoxicated. He was originally...
No, he sobered up eventually.
Eventually he did, after getting sick. But and the first part of his confession was concerning unrelated events. And then later on in the afternoon, they got to the events which occurred at Ms. Hutchler's residence. And he did not mention...
There's nothing at all to indicate he was... with anybody at the time?
Nothing in his statement.
What other evidence might there be?
Well, and there are police reports which seem to indicate that other persons were involved.
What does it say?
For example, there was a dog tracking which occurred, and these again were in reports which were not provided to the Supreme Court during the course of the direct appeal. But there was a dog tracking.
The investigation of a crime scene is usually, particularly a murder scene, is so thorough they write down everything. So dog tracks, unless you could indicate that there were something suspicious about dog tracks, is it this kind of dogless neighborhood that we're talking about, isn't it?
Trial counsel didn't even know that the dog tracking had occurred.
What the hell difference did it make?
And the reason why it's significant is because during the course of the statement that Johnson made later on that afternoon, he took the police back. The police took him back to the Hutzler residence with the videotape, and he showed the areas in which he traveled. And I don't exactly recall, but let's say he went to the right, and he said that he took certain items and he threw them, and the dog tracked where he said that he went. 2 days after he was incarcerated, some children found some items behind the market in a different location that turned out to have come from the Hutzler residence. And the dog did not track, despite the fact Johnson never said he went in that direction. The dog did not track in that direction, which would seem to indicate that the items were placed there after Johnson was put in custody.
Or somebody moved them.
Or they were, yes, yeah, certainly. Thank you, judges.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Krause. Mr. Creason.
May it please the court. There are a number of things about this case that there is no argument on. First is that Gregory Scott Johnson is guilty of the murder and arson of Ruby Hutzler and her house. The second is that counsel, perhaps inadvertently, but nevertheless counsel filed the habeas petition 1 day late when it knew of all of the facts necessary to raise the claim under Brady.
It is. That's what this argument has been about. They contest whether it was late or not.
Yes, Your Honor.
You have 1 year under 2244 D1D from the date on which the factual predicate of the claim was discovered. Right? So they're arguing that this petition was timely.
There's nothing, Your Honor, about this claim, however, that is different than the claim raised in the state post-conviction courts and litigated on at trial level and on appeal. The only thing that is different is that now we have a court order. But there was no doubt that the court order existed. It just could not be found. Nor is there any doubt that some application, verbal or written, had to have been made.
Let me interrupt for purposes of clarification. Counsel's brief for the appellant is on page 3, contains this statement, first full sentence. Johnson filed his petition for writ of habeas corpus in the capital case June 29, 1999. The petition was filed one date past the one-year statute of limitations, period. So that aspect is not contested.
That is true, unless the claim could not have been asserted earlier.
One year past the statute of limitations.
That is correct. The equitable tolling provisions don't apply, however, because I suppose I should be more exact. I apologize, John. The equitable tolling provisions, the statutory equitable tolling provisions, don't come into play because Johnson knew of the claim and knew that he wanted the evidence long before his post-conviction petition was ever litigated. I mean, it was in the middle of them. Presumably, the claim was known long before a direct appeal.
Making that issue altogether, what is it that the government had, that the government of Indiana has, that they haven't given the defendant?
I do not know what has been given. and what has not. I have not looked at the files myself. I have no personal knowledge of it.
However, the thing you heard argue is the statute of limitations. You have no idea the underlying cause?
I do know, Your Honor, that the state of Indiana has given everything that is required under Brady v. Maryland under to the defense. That is the basis for the equitable tolling claim.
What have you got that you didn't give them that isn't the basis for any claim?
Evidence relating to investigation, or not evidence, excuse me, information developed that is was not used perhaps at trial. I'm speculating. I do not know what has or has not. But the state post-conviction court litigated this, and the prosecutor's office said that all that needed to be turned over had been turned over. The district court denied an evidentiary hearing, so the record
essentially the judge relied entirely on the prosecutor's statement that there was other evidence, but it wasn't other documents, that they were not exculpatory, therefore he didn't have to give.
Well, some of them were placed under seal in the record and are.
But some why? Yeah, but those are available to defense. They've already said they were available.
Yes, Your Honor, and the nature of Brady is that it's executing on the part of the prosecutor. The prosecutors, sometimes the prosecutor doesn't even know of the evidence, but
yeah.
The prosecutor, is held to it. I mean, the prosecutor is the one that under Brady is charged with knowing what he has.
But if I understand what you're saying is that the prosecutor's statement that he has no other evidence that's exculpatory that's required under Brady is sufficient by itself to stop any further investigation by either court or counsel to find out whether that's a deadly accurate statement or a misstatement, an error, or whatever. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it is to the extent that the court believes the prosecutor over mere speculation on the part of the defense. The defense is not entitled under post-conviction to retry its case, to
cover
the prosecutor's files and discovery.
Anything wrong with the prosecutor seeing the judge, we don't have anything. If you want to see it, I'll show it to you. Here it is. Here's my file.
And I believe...
Which is normally the way it's handled, is it not?
Normally, yes. And
what's abnormal about this case?
On my recollection of the way that the post-conviction court, in short, nothing is irregular about this case, Your Honor. The post-conviction court was offered, I believe, and this is off the top of my head, I really cannot give you a citation to the record supporting this, and Ms. Krause may disagree with me.
She may get up and hit you in the head when she was back for rebuttal if you say something wrong, but go ahead.
The record show, I believe the record will show that the prosecutors had allowed, or would allow the court to review the files, but not Johnson's counsel. To the extent that they were not impounded, or that defense counsel did not seek it, or that the trial court didn't grant that, those would be issues for appeal or strategy.
Did the trial court, you don't know whether the trial court took up that splendid offer.
Unfortunately, Your Honor, and I apologize, I do not know. The counsel raises another argument in their brief relating to the delay by the post office, and the state believes that allowing the post office did not inordinately delay the filing of the petition. It was delivered in the normal course of business, perhaps longer than what mail sometimes takes, which is one day apparently, from Fort Wayne to Indianapolis, but it was delivered in three post office business days, which is standard practice, and counsel had other more reliable, faster methods available to deliver a habeas petition that had been due for a year, that was available to be filed, no new claims, no new evidence comes to light that made the habeas petition any different. Equitable tolling is simply inappropriate in this case, and the state asks that this court affirm the judgment of the district court.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Creason. Anything further, Ms. Krause?
In response to Judge Easterbrook's a question earlier. The date upon which the court order was found was March 31st of 1999. So that was the date when the court order was located in microfilm. But again, the application, which is really where the information is going to be obtained, is what has been sought diligently.
I know, but you knew about the following your own rationalization. Once you know that there's an order, you know there's an underlying document. You ask for it, you don't get it, and boom. That's when your writ's filed. Same day, same time, same station.
But then the claim is being, the writ is being filed without the information. And if the appellant has...
Is that when they made the demand? Was the demand made for the underlying document for the search, the application of the search?
The demand was made in May of 1999 prior to the running of... prior to the June 28th, I believe, was the date upon which the 1 year was going to expire. So it was made prior to that date running. And again, the pre-petition discovery, the ex parte discovery, laid out...
You were not present, neither was I, and obviously neither was your opponent present for the post-conviction hearing.
I was present.
Were you there?
Yes, I was.
Were the documents offered by the prosecution to the judge when he said there was nothing exculpatory there?
No, Judge. In fact, we had located those additional police reports, we being the defense.
Yes, and you offered them to the judge.
We moved to admit them. The prosecutor objected to the admission of those documents, stating that they had not come from his office.
Move over.
Sorry.
See, you're going to miss some golden words.
So the prosecutor actually objected to the admission of those documents on the basis that they had not come from his office because they'd been obtained pursuant to a subpoena directly from either the police or the fire department.
Did he question our authenticity?
He did. The prosecutor did on the basis that he had no knowledge of them.
There's a lot of proofs going on in the world he probably doesn't know the first thing about. But what was his beef about those documents? And first of all, what sort of predicate were they for any ruling you wanted?
Well, it was the reports that were being admitted.
Was there anything around those reports that was exculpatory for your client?
Absolutely, Judge.
What?
The information about the court order, the information, the police report about the taking of the pubic hairs, the additional reports about...
All of this revolves upon whether or not the results of the pubic hair investigation would have put somebody else into the building.
That was one part of it, the pubic hair.
Well, what else would there be?
Well, there were statements from other witnesses, and those
were unavailable to you?
Those were unavailable to trial counsel.
All right. You have them now. Is there anything in any of those statements that would be indications of exculpatory material?
Oh yes, sir. And
like what?
Well, the girlfriend, Kathy Monday, Mundy, uh-huh. who, for example, she provided an alibi for Paul Decker. There were statements then. She was interviewed several times by the police officers during the course of the investigation. She changed her information concerning that alibi. And, in fact, one officer said in the report, I think if they break up or not long or together, she'll come forward. There was this information about the dog tracking. There was information about Paul Decker being in possession of drugs, prescription drugs, which had allegedly come from Mrs. Hutzler's residence.
But there is not one single piece of evidence that puts anybody in that area, in that building, except your client.
I would disagree with that.
Well, else is there in evidence now that shows that?
If Decker was in...
No. Listen to my question. What in the record can we rely on to show that there's some evidence that somebody else was in the building at the time of the crime other than your client? Since we know he was there because he said he was and told him cold, sober, and dead drunk what happened both times.
He
even took him on a reenactment.
Yes. There may not be direct evidence.
I want any evidence.
Well, If Paul Decker was in possession of drugs...
Yes, go ahead.
If Paul Decker was in possession of drugs, which he told somebody had come from the Hutzler residence, that is indication, that is certainly circumstantial indication that he was in the residence.
Is there such a statement?
I'm sorry?
Is there such a statement?
Yes, Judge, I believe there is, and I believe it's in our brief concerning what those statements are. There is also information from Kathy Monday.
How is it evidence, right? If A is charged with killing drug dealer Smith, and B admits that he bought drugs from drug dealer Smith, how does that exculpate A?
If you have that additional fact that B bought from
right.
But we don't have that fact here. We don't know, there's no information that Decker obtained these drugs from anybody else.
Your claim is weaker.
Sorry?
Your claim is weaker than the one that I just stated, but the one, as I stated it, is not exculpatory evidence for A.
With that additional fact that he bought it from somebody else, that fact is not in this record, Judge. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much. And Ms. Krause, we extend our particular thanks to you for accepting the appointment. These capital cases are always very hard, and we appreciate the assistance you've been to your client and to us. Thank you very much.
Judge.
The case is taken under advisement.
Thank you.